In your minds, I want you to put yourself on the walls of Jerusalem, watching as one of the most massive and well-organized armies of the ancient world stood to conquer the city. Situation was dire. The armies of the mighty Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, stood outside the very gates of Jerusalem. But recognizing the high cost of a direct assault on the city, the Assyrians waged a twofold battle. They waged both a military and a psychological war against the kingdom of Judah. We read about this in Isaiah chapters 36 and 37. But I want you to especially focus in on Isaiah 37 verses, or 36 verses 13 to 16. Isaiah 36, 13. Then Rabshakeh, now this is the Assyrian officer of the highest rank, stood and cried with a loud voice in the Jews' language and said, "Hear ye the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus saith the king, let not Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you. Neither let Hezekiah make you trust in Jehovah, saying, Jehovah will surely deliver us. This city will not be given into the hand of the king of Assyria. Hearken not to Hezekiah, for thus saith the king of Assyria, make your peace with me. Come out unto me, and eat ye every one under his vine, and every one under his fig tree." You see, even the Assyrians knew of the promises of God. And they knew that if they said to the people, "We're going to give you what good things God has promised," that would soften the blow of coming into the Assyrian Empire. King Hezekiah laid before the Lord the arrogant letter of Sennacherib that stood as a reproach to the living God. And we read about this in Isaiah chapter 37. But then the Lord sent word by his prophet Isaiah to bolster the king's courage. And I want to turn just a little bit further into Isaiah 37 and read verses 21 through 25. Then Isaiah the son of Amos sent unto Hezekiah, saying, "Thus saith the Lord, whom have you defied and blasphemed?" Let's start with 21. "Thus saith Jehovah, the God of Israel, whereas you have prayed to me against Sennacherib, king of Assyria, this is the word which Jehovah has spoken concerning him. The virgin daughter of Zion hath despised thee, and laughed thee to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee. Whom hast thou defied and blasphemed, and against who hast thou exalted thy voice and lifted up thine eyes on high, even against the Holy One of Israel?" If we move down 10 verses, let us follow how the Lord of hosts fashioned the military response to Sennacherib's assault on Jerusalem, starting in verse 33. "Therefore, thus saith Jehovah concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come unto this city, nor shoot an arrow there, neither shall he come before it with shield, nor cast up a mound against it. By the way he came, by the same he shall return. He shall not come into this city, saith Jehovah, for I will defend this city to save it, for my own sake, and for my servant David's sake. And the angel of the Lord went forth and smote the camp of the Assyrians, 185,000. And when the men arose early in the morning, behold, these were all dead bodies." Now the Assyrian army retreated to Nineveh in tatters, and King Sennacherib perished at the hands of his own sons. Thus were the Assyrians defeated militarily. But dear brethren, we jumped ahead in this story. Before the Lord's angel wrought deliverance, an equally important victory had already been won. And this was the battle for the hearts and the courage of the defenders. And I wanted us to focus on the psychological warfare, because this has application to our day. It was part of this campaign. the threat that Sennacherib brought to Jerusalem was real. And the Lord's wreaking destruction on them through his angel was also real. But do you remember the Lord's first words to Hezekiah? Were they about deliverance via a destroying angel? They weren't. In response to this national emergency, a trilogy of three psalms was composed. Now, my reference for this comes from the Sansino Jewish commentary. The Christian commentaries have some different ideas. I think Sansino is correct. These psalms were Psalm 46, Psalm 47, and Psalm 48. Depending on the version of the Bible you have, you will see this superscription there that these are songs upon Alamoth. And you may have read that and may have wondered, what is a song upon Alamoth? Well, that's what we're going to talk about. Let's look back at Isaiah 37:22. And this is the word which Jehovah has spoken concerning him. Now that's meaning concerning Sennacherib. The virgin daughter of Zion hath despised thee and laughed thee to scorn. The daughter of Jerusalem hath shaken her head at thee. What does that mean? If we look at this word Alamoth, it's Strong's word 5961 for girls. And the scholars are unanimous on this. But after agreeing on that, they don't know where to go. A song upon girls. And let's see, we have two slumbering girls here. We have Trine and Takia, but that's okay. We'll get them the CD later. And for this psalm, there's something very, very important. Because to be consistent with the promise that we have in Isaiah 37:22, what makes the most sense is to recognize that when it speaks about the virgin daughters of Zion who were to sing, and they apparently had this divinely commanded, insolent little shake of the head and this laugh of scorn, they were going to be the ones singing the psalm. These three psalms are very different than the ones that were going to be sung in the temple. These were going to be sung by the young women. Why? Because the young women had the privilege of singing the victory songs in ancient Israel. That was their job. In victory, they were the ones who went through the streets and led the celebration of the people. And so here we have three psalms that are being composed while there's an enemy outside the wall for the purpose of singing about the Lord's victory. Sieges in ancient times could be many years long. All the besieging army needed to do was encompass the city and then wait it out while the defenseless population inside the walls could have this demoralizing period of misery, famine, thirst, disease. That's what worked on behalf of the invaders. But when we turn to Psalm 46, we read, God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Therefore will we not fear, though the earth be removed, and though the mountains be carried into the midst of the sea. Now this psalm is for all seasons of life. But we need to hear it first through the voices of these virgins, the future mothers of Israel. And imagine that you're a soldier on the wall looking out at this massive Assyrian encampment, and your heart grows faint. Then furtively you would glance around at your homes in the city, the tents of the refugees. The streets are always crowded. They're even more crowded than normal because of everybody who's come into the city to escape from the Assyrians. And in the midst of this chaotic scene, you catch the strains of a psalm of praise. And soon you see your own daughters. You see your little sisters. your nieces, the neighbor girls. You see the sun and the shadows playing on their long flowing hair. And they're dancing, because that's what the young women were supposed to do in the victory songs. And they're singing. And they're shaking their heads as the Lord commanded. Nowadays, if we have an interpretive translation, what Isaiah is saying is the virgin daughter of Zion is supposed to, I think the expression is, show some attitude. So, do you have new courage? Do you cast behind you these demoralizing words of Rabshakeh? And what would the words of this psalm have meant to those in Jerusalem under the threat of conquest by Assyria? Because there's a whole string of lessons to draw from this. Let's start with verse 1. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. The Lord was not far away or unmoved by the dangers that threatened them. He was present with his people in Jerusalem. Keep in mind what was happening in the history of this time. There had been a separation of the Lord's people because of unfaithfulness. But there had been a 10-tribe kingdom, and then the 2-tribe kingdom, which was Judah and Benjamin, that had, they share the city of Jerusalem. Judah and Benjamin share that city because it is on the border between the two. They stayed together. The others formed their own community, which had gone into grossest idolatry, and now had been taken exile by the Assyrians. Psalm 46, verse 2 says, "Therefore we will not fear, though the earth do change, and though the mountains be shaken into the heart of the seas, though the waters thereof roar and be troubled, though the mountains tremble with the swelling thereof." Selah. And political change is always an unwelcome guest, because it brings uncertainty. And the issues at hand were that these two great powers, which had threatened the existence of the nation that controlled Jerusalem, were now brought to an end. What were the two powers that threatened them? They were threatened by the 10-tribe kingdom of Israel, which had now formed an alliance with Syria. Keep this clear. Syria is one nation with a capital at Damascus. Assyria is a totally different nation with a capital at Nineveh. Now, the fall of both Syria and the 10 tribes was welcome in Judah. Not that their brethren were taken into captivity, but these ones had an intention of annihilating the nation of Judah. And there was another problem occurring at this period. The world was changing. Egypt had been a major world power since the flood. Since the flood, things got established in Egypt, and it had been an important kingdom. Their importance was coming to an end on the world scene at this time. But for God's people trusting in their fortress, the change brought about by rising political fortunes in Assyria was just another event. Precautions for defense were to be taken. But the Lord was in control, and it was not to be feared. And when this trilogy of Psalms was first sung, the people certainly understood that when there was a reference to mountains, this referred to the great kingdoms that threatened their existence. And we'll examine the meaning of seas later. But there's one image that would have been clear without going into the Bible's rich language, this symbolic language respecting sea. And here's the question I want to ask you. Once a mountain is shaken or struck by God's judgment, what do you have? Well, you have a pile of rubble. Now, there are a few scriptural ways to get rid of rubble piles. One of the ways to get rid of rubble piles is to melt it so that it flows away in a great puddle. And we'll see a reference to this in verse 6 of our psalm. The other, you can recall from the book of Daniel, is you take the pile of rubble and you grind it up and let the wind blow it away. Now, those are two scriptural ways to get rid of rubble piles, but the third one is talked about here. The fastest way to dispose of a rubble pile and get it out of sight is to pick it up and throw it into the sea. Then it disappears forever when the waves close over the top of it. In verse 46, we read, "There's a river, the streams whereof make glad the city of God, the holy place of the tabernacles of the Most High." Rabshakeh hurled a less than delicate warning to the men on the walls that the Assyrians were going to wait out the siege until the water supply in Jerusalem was exhausted. You can read about that in Isaiah 36:12, but this is not the sort of edifying thing we would like to talk about at a Sunday meeting. Sennacherib's military strategists had gathered their best military intelligence and recognized that the water supply of Jerusalem was a weakness. You know, lessons from history. Military intelligence isn't always correct and accurate. The Assyrians were unaware that in Jerusalem, a skillful tunneling effort had been executed with the highest urgency as soon as Hezekiah realized that the threat was real. Working continuously, day and night, two teams working far under the city had tunneled and actually came to within a foot and a half of each other, far under the city, and connected up to form an aqueduct that was now going to bring an assured water supply into the city of Jerusalem so that it could withstand the siege. And this aqueduct of Hezekiah carries the fresh water from the Pool of Siloam along with the natural ever-flowing waters of Shiloh to supply an ample amount of water to keep the city going. And the Assyrians were sure that they could wait out the siege until there'd be no water and you'd have to give up because Jerusalem's elevated. Jerusalem's river, an essential river of life during the siege, was to make glad the city of God. Now, we're going to go into the Antitype, brethren, but this is talking about what this psalm meant to those in Israel when it was first sung, what they were thinking and feeling and recognizing. This was about the water supply that was carrying them through. And let's just turn back to read Isaiah 8:5 to 10, because this is giving us some of the background history for this. "Because Jehovah spoke to me again, saying," and this is Isaiah 8:5, "For as much as this people have refused the waters of Shiloh that go softly." Now that was the natural water supply for Jerusalem. "And they rejoice in Rezin and Remaliah's son." And I've got to pause from the reading here. You'd have to go back into the history. These were the alliance that seemed unbreakable between Syria and the Ten Tribe Kingdom. That's what they're worried about here. That's what this references to. And the Syrians had changed the course of world warfare on top of that. They had a super weapon. You know, we don't really think too much about, what do the Syrians do besides terrorist attacks? Well, the Syrians were the ones who invented and first used steel. And so you're at a transition from the Bronze Age to the age where steel is going to be used in warfare from this point forward. And these weapons were far superior to anything that anybody else in the world had. Reading Isaiah 8:7, "Now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth upon them the waters of the river." Okay, we're going to follow this whole set of scriptural images on rivers. "Even the king of Assyria and all his glory shall come up over all its channels and go out over its banks." So the Assyrian flood, Sennacherib is going to be the way this Assyrian flood comes up, was going to cover Syria, the ten tribes, and sending them into captivity. And this was going to happen without Hezekiah's kingdom falling. To read verse 8 of Isaiah chapter 8, "It'll sweep onward into Judah. It'll overflow and pass through." In other words, nothing would happen. It would pass through, but nothing would happen. "It'll reach even to the neck That is, it would threaten Jerusalem, which is the head of the nation. Okay, so it's coming up to the neck. They're up to their neck in floodwaters, but it was under the Lord's control. Now, we don't have the time to go into the related scriptures about what the history was in this period, but it seemed as though everybody in Judah was very discouraged that now there was an alliance they could in no way defeat. And the Lord says, I'm going to defeat it. And he says how he's going to defeat it by telling them exactly what will take place through the words of Isaiah. But you know, they needed some reminding when they were all bottled up in the city, looking out at this Assyrian host that wanted to continue and conquer them. Are there some lessons there for how the Lord may deliver us from trials? Are there some lessons? I think there are. You know, we probably we could imagine in the council chambers of Hezekiah, they may have been wondering, we have faith in the Lord, but this really looks bad. This really looks bad. But the Lord had it under control and promised it ahead of time. And he didn't say, oh, I'm just going to take care of your enemies and, you know, they're going to just be swept away after that. He warned them that it was going to come in and all the way up to the neck, threatening the nation. And how did he respond to it? Three songs upon Alamoth. Psalm 46:5, God is in the midst of her, she shall not be moved. God will help her, and that right early. And this right early is clearly a veiled reference to the delivery of the nation when the angel of death came in and smote the Assyrian host. And the angel of Jehovah went forth and smote in the camp of Assyrian. When the men arose in the morning, behold, they were all dead bodies. Psalms 46, verse 6, the nations raged, the kingdoms were moved. He uttered his voice. The earth melted. Jehovah of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Though Syria had been neutralized as a threat, you know, you still had these two superpowers of Egypt and Assyria raging at each other, and lesser kingdoms such as Israel and Judah and others were really caught in the clash between these two superpowers that were trying to control the world. But all of that was to melt away when Jehovah but spoke the word. Whatever military strength and battle the hosts of the kingdom of man can boast, Jehovah of hosts is more than a match. And these spiritual battles are invisible to us, brethren. But we get a sense of the power of the Lord of hosts when arrayed against earthly forces when we read the incident in 2 Kings verse 16 where the eyes of Elisha's servant were open. 2 Kings 6:17, and Elisha prayed and said, Jehovah, I pray thee, open his eyes, a servant's eyes, that he may see. And Jehovah opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire around about Elisha. Yes, Jehovah is surely a refuge. He is a God who watches over the special interests of his natural seed. He's the God of Jacob. Psalm 46:8, come behold the works of Jehovah, what desolations he had made in the earth. Every single one of Judah's enemies was made desolate. Psalm 46:9, he maketh wars to cease unto the end of the earth. He breaketh the bow and cutteth the spear in sunder. He burneth the chariots. A better translation, if you don't have this in your margin, see if there's a note that says supply wagons in fire, in the fire. We'll get back to that when we get into the antitypes. Verse 10, be still and know that I am God. I will be exalted among the nations, and I'll be exalted in the earth. Jehovah of hosts is with us. The God of Jacob is our refuge. Selah. This psalm was of great encouragement and inspiration during the Reformation. Almost everyone associates Martin Luther with the book of Romans, and the just shall live by faith. But we tend to forget that Luther was converted not only by his study of Romans, but also by his study of the Psalms. Luther taught the Psalms for years and loved them very much throughout his life. But his favorite was Psalm 46. It is said of Luther that there were times during the dark and dangerous periods of the Reformation where he was terribly discouraged and depressed, but at such times he would turn to his friend and co-worker, Philip Melanchthon, and say, "Come, Philip, let's sing the 46th Psalm." And they would sing Luther's own strong version of it that we know as, "A mighty fortress is our God." So while this psalm has long served as an inspiration, what's the antitype for us? Because here we are at the end of the age. We could stop with these lessons of history that show us how the Lord is certain in delivery of his people, even though there could be what appears as a threat that could overwhelm you coming up to the neck. Let's take a look, because this psalm has special application in the closing days of this gospel age. Now, that comes from a very early reprint article, but I think it's a good idea. We've already seen that the Assyrians were outside the walls of Jerusalem to execute judgment against the enemies of Judah. What about the purpose of the trouble at this time? The root cause of the trouble in this present evil world is the condemnation which our race falls by nature. For we are all children of wrath, as Paul says in Ephesians. And while the sins of Judah were great, good King Hezekiah sincerely turned his heart towards Jehovah and hearkened unto the voice of Isaiah and trusted. And these words that we read here in trouble seem to have a special application to us, because we are in the great time of trouble that will entirely change the present course and construction of society. What a privileged time to live. Now, the Assyrians were not wonderful people. They were cruel. They were bitter. They were impetuous. They were rapacious. The Lord's using these kinds of agencies consistently to effect change is always a big surprise to his people. As an example, we find the puzzled discourse that Habakkuk had with Jehovah. He couldn't understand the judgments against the nation brought by the enemy of God's people. We read in Habakkuk 1, 5 through 6, and I'm reading this from the Jewish Publication Society version. "Look ye among the nations, and behold, and wonder marvelously, for behold, a work shall be wrought in your days, which you'll not believe, though it be told to you. For lo, I raise up the Chaldeans, that bitter and impetuous nation that march through the breadth of the earth to possess the dwelling places that are not theirs." And then move down to verse 13 of Habakkuk 1. Habakkuk says, "Thou art of purer eyes than to behold evil, and cannot look on perverseness. Wherefore lookest thou upon them that deal treacherously? And holdest thy peace when the wicked swallow up the man more righteous than he?" Now, this isn't just a question. It's actually a challenge, as we learn from reading Habakkuk 2, 1 and 2. "I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and look forth to see what he'll speak to me and what answer I shall receive concerning my complaint. And Jehovah said to me," what? "Write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it, that it may be read easily even by one that's running." What was his answer? Look at the chart. Look at the chart. Now, we don't have one here right now, but we saw it a little bit earlier. How do we understand why the Lord is permitting the suffering and the trouble of this time? Is that he delights in it? No. But this is the only way that change is going to be affected. And what does our perspective have to be? To be like Habakkuk, standing and trying to get the picture of the whole vision, where God is taking this. And what a privilege we have, brethren. What a privilege we have, because we do have this vision. We have the meet and do season at this period that has been so richly and abundantly provided for us. And we need to be feeding on that. The writings of our pastor. The present time, you know, let's bring it down to our day. I get emails, communications, all from well-meaning brethren, and they sound like Habakkuk. Well, they tell me, what do they tell me? Islamic fundamentalists, both Sunni and Shiite, are not nice people. I get those kind of emails. I don't know if you do. The leaders of the Russian Federation are not nice people. The grab bag of crazies running the stans are not nice people. The Chinese aren't much better. Domestic politics, liberal politicians are not nice people. Oh, that's not your flavor? Conservative politicians aren't nice people. I get it from both sides, brethren. Fill in the blank are not nice people. You know, we keep going on. No, the Lord is not going to use nice people to bring this old order to its end and bring in the new order. He hasn't done that in the past, nor will he do it now. We need to be focused on the vision so that we can see where all of this is leading through and that all of these are just agencies. And the brethren that do concern me are the ones who think, oh, no, we better support this agency. Well, brethren, we are above politics if we stand on the tower and hold to the vision. I am apolitical. I've had problems with both sides. I'm apolitical. I love them in the kingdom. But anyway, they keep asking this question, why do you hold your peace when the wicked swallows up the man that's more righteous? And the answer is that our refuge has to be Jehovah. And we have to have a rest of both faith and knowledge. But a knowledge of what? Really, a confidence in what we have learned in the divine plan of the ages. You're not going to find anything that's going to give you peace and show you that vision that's going to carry you through the time of trouble otherwise. And look at how patient God was with Habakkuk's question. You know, this is a very perplexing question, and he didn't get a rebuke from God, but he was told to write down the vision and make it plain upon tables. Hence, armed with both faith and knowledge, we have full assurance that God is our refuge and strength and a very present help in trouble. And when we look at Psalm 46:2, we will not fear though the earth do change and the mountain be shaken into the hearts of the seas. Because we've made the Lord our refuge and habitation, and we're waiting for and expecting to see Messiah's heavenly kingdom introduced, because we know that at the same time our redemption draws nigh, we don't fear. The saints don't rejoice in the trouble, but they are at rest while others are lamenting and weeping. Though the earth do change and the mountains be shaken into the heart of the sea, the trouble on the earth will not reach its full intensity until the shaking of the heavens, ecclesiasticism with all its God-dishonoring errors, is removed. A very early reprint, and this is 511, suggests that Psalms 46 sets forth a complete picture of the seventh plague of Revelation. For we see not just trouble, but those governments, every form of civil power that dominates society, scripturally pictured by these mountains, being carried into the midst of the seas, that is, into the lawless, ungovernable masses of anarchy which swallow up the false systems. And it's important for us to focus on that image that Psalm 46:3 brings to us and explore it, because we're told that the waters thereof roar, are troubled, the mountains tremble with the swelling thereof. This is the problem that the kingdoms of this world are having. And doesn't this image marvelously represent the infuriated passions of this uncontrollable sea, the faceless masses? Mankind, individually, we're A drop in the bucket. Individually, that's what we are. But collectively, mankind is a sea that swallows up mountains. Knowing human nature, we already know, unfortunately, that the response of mankind will not be to turn to God. That's one of the reasons for the extremity of the trouble. And we should not think that either new or stronger leaders or new and stronger extra legal measures, and you note my political correctness there, I won't say illegal, will meet with any success. But these are things we should be expecting in the future, brethren, because we study history since it casts a light forward on what will happen. Mankind consistently makes the same mistakes. And we see that the governments will try to hold back the ungovernable passions and forces of society, which really will not answer to any leader. And hence, this image of the sea is meaningful in so many ways. Again, to quote Pastor Russell, this is reprint 1470, when commenting on this psalm. We as the Lord's people need to recognize that what he calls retributive and purgatorial troubles will make the subtle parts of the earth tremble for fear and insecurity. As always in trouble, there's a special test for the Lord's people. Are we making God our refuge? Think back to Hezekiah and what they faced with the annihilation that the Assyrians were going to pour upon them if they breached the walls. He shakes and sifts the world that he may separate the many who have assumed the name of Christ but are not truly his people. And notice again that God's provisions are to supply for every need. Every need, even in this trouble, to sustain us through the siege. For there is a river, the river of salvation, the river of living waters that we have available to drink during the siege, brethren. This is such a privilege. And the picture doesn't stop here, for someday this river will flow out and bless all of mankind with the waters of life. Though at present the waters may glad those who have made God their refuge, it's not that we rejoice in our own security regardless of the woes of others. That's reprint 686. But here again, we have a strong proof of the prophetic nature of this psalm, which goes far beyond this Assyrian invasion. There is a river that whereof make glad the city of God, the holy places of the tabernacles of the Most High. Notice it's in the plural. We're running a little short on time here. So I'm just going to suggest to you that if you look, you will see tabernacle singular. For example, a tabernacle of God is with men is not what's being referred to. This is a besieged city with tabernacles plural, which is a picture of each of the individual members of the church. You know, I look out here and I see tabernacling saints being referred to in this psalm. 46:5, God is in her midst, she shall not be moved. God will help her at the dawning of her morning. I'd like to jump down to verse 9. Not only are wars to cease, but scholars such as Isaac Leeser recognize that the word is not chariots here, but wagons, those that supply the armies. What a strange thing to refer to. And they're to be burned in fire. And this seems to be a special reference to problems in the old order for those that are actually supplying all the armaments that are keeping this trouble going. But that's just a suggestion we will leave with you. There is a related type at the close of this age that I'd like to conclude with. If we turn to 1 Kings 19, verse 11, you know this account of the experiences of Elijah. That's the church in the flesh. The Lord said in verse 1 Kings 19:11, "Go forth and stand upon the mount of the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a wind, great and strong, rending the mountains and breaking in pieces the rocks, went before the Lord." But the Lord wasn't in the wind. And after the wind was an earthquake, but the Lord wasn't in the earthquake. And after the earthquake was a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire was the sound of a soft whisper. That's Isaac Leeser. And it came to pass that when Elisha heard it, he concealed his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave. The scriptures are consistent in their promise. After 6,000 years of human pride and boasting, a command will come from the Lord. Be still. Psalm 46:10. After the fire, a still, small voice. Desist from your former ways, O people. And this is God's message to the babbling, clamorous, self-asserting humanity in this time of trouble. For out of this commotion and these stormy seas, God will bring order and peace. And know, that is, come to a recognition and a knowledge. What will they know? That I am God. I will be exalted.